So let me tell you how I got into this death stuff. I've had a number of really life-changing experiences that compelled me to dive very, very deeply into this material. Not only the doctrinal study of it, which has been exhaustive for me, I love to read. But really, more importantly, is that the practices, the death-related practices, and there are many really, really profound, incredibly profound practices that prepare you for dying. We're not just talking about what happens after you die. We're talking about what happens after the death of every day, after the death of every thought, after the death of every experience. There's always a gap. There's always a bardo. So that's what makes this stuff so cool. And so we'll be framing this discussion towards a preparatory dialogue, you know, towards death at the end of life. But we are involved with countless mini deaths throughout the day. According to the Bun tradition, which is the indigenous shamanistic tradition of Tibet, prior to the influx of Buddhism, we have about 84,000 thoughts a day. Modern psychology, by the way, estimates this about 60,000. In my own mind, that's a vast underestimation. I have at least 100,000. But that means that we are giving birth 84,000 times a day. There's a little microgenetic expression of birth, abiding, and death. Birth, abiding, and death. Birth, abiding, and death. So the first life transformative experience for me that directed me towards this incredible body of teachings was when I went to India for the first time. I've been to India many, many times because we work over there a lot. And has anybody been to Varanasi? Yeah, maybe you've done this. Maybe you've done this. You know, I spent a month in India the first time, and we did the legendary boat trip along the Ganges. Did you do that? Yeah. And I remember, I mean, I can tell you, I can even just smell it right now. We went to the Burning Ghats. Yeah, and you know, this is the greatest place to be cremated in India. So there's a constant, I mean, literally just a constant parade of bodies coming to the Ghats. And I remember, I felt a little uneasy doing this, but my Indian guide was just like so matter of fact about it, I went along with it. So we pulled up, it's towards the southern end of the river. We pulled off to this platform, which is about half the size of a football field. And there must have been 10 bodies actively being burned. And in the background was just this huge mass of wood that was used for the crematoriums. And then behind that was hospice, which we visited after this, where the people that were about to die were like, you know, in the waiting room, so to speak. So I remember walking out on this burning ghat, and you know, it was, to say it was surreal is an understatement. You know, here I am, this lily white boy from the West, where death is basically synonymous with pornography. We have no relationship to death in this world. So I go over there, and here I am literally walking between, I mean, just feeling the heat and the smell. You can imagine, and literally limbs falling off. It's what we call charnel ground in Tibetan. It's just where you know, the things are just so raw. And I remember standing in the middle of this ghat thinking like, wow. You know, I mean, I am experiencing death at a level I have never experienced before. It really shook me. And I became, I wouldn't say pathological, but close. For the next 5 days when we were there, while my friends that I was traveling with, three other friends, they would go off and you know, listen to some sitar music, which is great. I did that too. I went back to the ghats every night. You know, even as often as I could, I went back to the river to just sit there and contemplate death. And it really transformed me. And it reminded me of a very powerful statement that the Buddha once said, where he said, you know, of all footprints, the footprint of the elephant is the deepest and most supreme. Of all contemplations, the contemplations on impermanence and death are the deepest and most supreme. So it was really, it was a massive wake-up call for me, you know, in terms of like waking up from the denial of death. So the second experience happened a number of years later when I was requested by my meditation director, the center I was at in Denver, to teach a course on this bardo literature. And I don't know if you've spent any time. Has anybody spent time with this arena, like reading the Tibetan Book of the Dead? And yeah, it's rather complicated material. And it's vast. I mean, you know, this literature is really quite something. And I said, okay, well, let me think about it. You know, give me a decade. And so I started, you know, just reading everything I could. And about 6 months into this kind of preliminary research into teaching, I started doing a few little talks on the topic. And one day I got a call out of the blue. And I remember it so clearly. This woman called me. She got my number. She called the Boulder Shambhala Center, which is the big epicenter in Colorado. And she said, you know, I need help. My husband's dying. What do I do? And I go, I don't know, but there's an expert down, you know, there's an expert up there. You know, that'd be me. So, you know, nobody was teaching this stuff in our community. And I said, well, this seems kind of weird. So anyway, so this woman calls me, Susan, that's not her real name, but she called me, and she was living way out in, you know, somewhere in Timbuktu, Colorado, in the farm country, and her husband, her beloved husband of 40 or 50 years, was dying, and he had, you know, like just a couple days left to live. And she was just beside herself. She said she wasn't Buddhist, but Buddhism did relate to her, and that she wanted to know, like, what can I do to help my husband? And my first response was, like, I didn't say it. It was like, I don't know. But then I realized this woman had nobody else. I mean, there really wasn't anybody else out there. And I didn't really know anybody but the masters like Sogyal Rinpoche, because there weren't that many books back then. So what proceeded to happen over the next couple of days until her husband died, every day she would call me, and this is like no exaggeration, I would sit with Sogyal Rinpoche's Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, which still remains of the 50 books that are out there, it's still the best. If you're going to get one book next to mine. His book, the Tibetan Book of Living and Dying, which intimates the relationship of how these teachings really do apply towards life. I would literally hold this book in my left hand, actually it might have been in my right hand because I was holding a phone in my left. She would ask me a question, and if I really didn't know, I'd say, well, I have to call you back. You know, oh, honey, you know, it's like, but I would be flipping through the pages, like, you know, trying to help this poor woman deal with her husband who is dying. And as comical as that may have been from my end, what really, really struck me, and I think I share the story in the book, is that very often when I was talking to her, as I was talking, I would hear her whisper on the other end, I wish I would have prepared. I wish I was ready. I wish I was ready. And for some reason, it just like those burning gas, it hit me like a thunderbolt, because here was this woman with her husband trying to really be what I now refer to as a midwife into the bardos, trying to deliver her husband into a new dimension of existence. And she had no idea what to do. And she was beside herself in terms of guilt and regret. And I made a little vow to myself at that point that I would do whatever I could to help people from going through that experience.